Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah, yeah. A-Dream in the building. Shout out to Bree.
What up, Bree?
And we finna go in. Look.
Yes, sir.
Look. We came to break down a few topics here. So if you got time, sit and acknowledge it. It's positive, uplifting, and honest here. Keep your ears open and soaking all the words spoken. A couple of jokes to keep it fun, get your laugh on. And maybe a few pointers to get your cash on. See Bree, she all about building. Straight up out the NY, Brooklyn in the building. All the way down to the southern states. West Coast on up to the Great Lakes. So you fragging echoes, so if you ain't fragile, through the net connection, we streaming you to Mexico. So welcome to the life of Bree, breaking down relationships to the third degree.
This is the Bree life, what you live in life.
Welcome to the Bree life, how we live in life. From politics to the current events, economics to race, whether you're poor or you're rich.
This is the Bree life, what you live in life.
Welcome to the Bree life, how we live in life.
Coming to you live and streaming to all four points of the globe. It's your girl, Brooklyn born and Crown Heights raised. Living life and breathing life. It's Bree, baby.
Peace and blessings. It's your girl, Bree, and you're listening to the Bree Life Radio Show. Tonight, we're going to do what we normally do. We provoke peripheral thought through provocative dialogue. Our topic tonight is a part two of Where Are All the Black Leaders and Black Organizations? But before we start, I'd like to mention just a few things. Firstly, I want to extend a very happy, healthy, and safe Thanksgiving to the whole entire Bree Life Radio family. And on Thanksgiving Day, I have been extended an invitation from Lieutenant Frank Simpson Jr. To attend services at the Ilium International Fellowship Church. The Archbishop Eugene James Blunt and Canon Pastor Maurice Powell will be officiating services that day. Ilium will also be serving Thanksgiving dinner to those who are homeless and have also suffered at the loss of Storm Sandy. So after services, I will be assisting with serving dinner because I just feel that I'd like to do something for those who are in need on that day, because I'm very thankful for the blessings that my Creator has extended to me. Services will be from 10 o'clock to 12:30, and afterwards, dinner will be served from 1 to 6 p.m. So spread the word and share the fellowship. At the end of the show, I will go over this again, so I can share with you the information for the address and where you would go to participate. Also, New Yorkers for Great Public Schools is having an education town hall on Wednesday, November 28th from 6:30 p.m. to 8 p.m. at First Corinthians Baptist Church. The address is 1912 Adam Clayton Powell Jr. Boulevard. That's at 116th Street in Harlem. Pastor Michael Wallround Jr. will be speaking. And one of our guest panelists this evening, Zakiya Ansari, who happens to be the advocacy director for Alliance, will also be sponsoring this event. So it's a worthwhile event to participate. Even though it's being held in Harlem, it affects all New York City schools. So, and we want better education for all of our school-age children. So go out and support the event. Again, that's on Wednesday, November 28th. from 6:30 p.m. to 8 p.m. Also, another announcement, I have decided the Bree Life Radio Network is going to start a Bree Life Foundation, and one of our platforms will be a youth initiative for teenagers from ages 13 to 17. We're going to have a media arts program, and this program will give students an opportunity to learn about broadcasting, producing, and all different types of media arts. The program will begin in February of 2013. So for all those who are interested and know children that may have an interest in television or radio, performing arts, media arts, contact me at BriLifeRadio@gmail.com. That's B-R-I-L-I-F-E radio@gmail.com. Also, you can follow us on Bree Life Radio at Twitter and Bree Life Radio at Facebook. So, tonight we're going to have a great discussion. Again, it's part two of Where Are All the Black Leaders and Organizations? I'm going to be joined tonight again with a great friend to the Bree Life Radio Show, and his name is General Parker. He is the founder of Illinois Fathers Incorporated, and we'll bring General on the line right now. Peace and blessings, General.
Happy holidays, Bree.
Happy holidays. How are you?
Well, you know, for an old ugly man, I'm not doing too bad.
Okay. Well, that's good to know. So, as you know, we're having part two of our very provocative discussion from a couple of weeks ago, which I got a lot of great feedback. One for your impromptu hosting, which I appreciate, in the absence of someone who was supposed to help me. So last minute you stepped up, and I really appreciate it. And you did such a great job that I had to bring you back to do it again.
Thanks.
So thank you very much. This topic, and actually the question that I posed to, you know, our Facebook community, to my community at large, has sort of I don't even know how to say it. It has provoked some heated discussions, some interesting discussions, and I'm just wondering what the concern about my question is. I think it's a fair question. It's not a question by no means to minimize the diligent work that many community leaders and politicians are doing in communities all over the country. It's an observation that I made based on my own community that I live in, that I've lived in 40-plus years, and certain changes, some for the best and some that, you know, haven't been so great. So I wanted to pose this question. And I caught a little heat, which, you know, doesn't bother me because I've been drinking milk. I'm a big girl, and I could take heat from the best of them. So, but I thought it was a fair question to ask. And let's talk about some leadership. You know, there are some that would suggest that it was too soon for Barack Obama to become president. And it's my belief that this was his time. It couldn't have been a more perfect time in our current history. His presence, in many regards, has re-energized the need for leadership, and has many people in their own respective communities asking, "Where are all the black leaders and organizations?"
Right.
So we'll ask the question, and the question may continue to be asked beyond tonight, but for the 2 hours, we're going to have some really great panelists that are very present and provide their communities with tireless hours of outreach and public service. Tonight, we're being joined with Kadia Ansari. She's the Advocacy Director of Alliance Quality Education. We'll also be joined with Robert E. Carnegie, Jr. He is the Legislative Policy Analyst for the New York City Council. Timothy James, who is a good friend to the Bree Life Radio Show. He's the Special Assistant and Education Constituent at the New York State Assembly. So before we bring our panelists on, General, why don't you reintroduce yourself to our listeners and just give them a flavor for what you do in your community and what one of your platforms and causes have been, because you've put some tireless hours and energy into that cause. And just for the listeners' information, General will be joining us next week along with Michael McCormick to discuss part three, which is a discussion we had several months ago about child custody and child support. Is it friend or foe? So, General, if you could please just, you know, share with us what you do and what you've been doing in your community.
Well, thank you, Bree. I appreciate that. And, again, I just want to let everybody know that I appreciate what you do there in New York, and I appreciate the service that you're giving to people around the country right now with your show and the issues that you're bringing about. And it is always an honor and a privilege to work alongside of you. My name is General Parker, and I'm Executive Director for an organization called Illinois Fathers here in the state of Illinois. What we do is we work to try to not only bring non-custodial parents together with their alienated children, but to educate our legislature, our schools, our court system, to understand that children need both parents, not just in the baby-making process, but in the child-rearing process and even into adulthood. So once we get that established, I think you'll see better communities and better neighborhoods, and you can start talking about turning your neighborhoods around once you get the family unit back together. So that's been a big passion of mine. We've been working to change laws. We try not to work so much on the lobbying side, but more on the educational side. We try to do things to make the court system more fair, more balanced, instead of finding a lot of the prejudices that you find in family court today. And we try to get that click out of the family court system, like it ain't what you know or it's who you know and stuff like that. So because you're tearing families apart, and we're trying to get rid of that because it's affecting our community, especially more so the African-American community. So those are some of the things that I do. But getting to our issue tonight, it's strange because, I do a lot of community activism and political activism here in Peoria. I ran for mayor here 4 years ago, and it's just funny when you talk about black leadership. And just like you, we're not posing this question, you know, to try to disrespect any of the black leaders. I brought a well-known author, Michelle Alexander, to Peoria a couple of years ago. She has authored a book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. And I announced a lot of the black leaders in this area at that symposium that we had that night. And I made it clear I may not agree with everything that they do or say, just like they may not agree with everything that I do or say, but I will never take away any of the contributions that they made to our culture and our community, you know. And I asked that nobody in the room would ever do that either. But at the same time, I know from the time that I grew up, and the civil rights movement and all the different organizations back then in the 60s and the 70s that were out there for the black community to go to for resources and help. And I know some of these organizations. I know some of these people. And I would like to pose that same question to the listeners. From the organizations and the leaders that you knew back then, from the 70s, 60s, or 50s, when you call in, tell about those organizations and what you think that they did for the black community, and try to tell us what you think that they are or they aren't doing today. And then we can probably more so find out exactly where these leaders are, where they've gone to. And that's all we're trying to find out. Where are the black leaders today? That's all, Bree.
And not only do we want to find out where they are, because we know that there are many that are present and actively working in communities all over the country, but we want to talk with them. We want to understand what they're doing for their community, because maybe we can learn from one another and improve on activities, much-needed activities, that may not exist in your community right now. But if you hear something that another community leader or elected official is sponsoring in their communities, maybe you can piggyback off of that and improve the quality of life in your community. And that's
right.
Why I'm posing. I'm
right.
Sorry?
I just said right.
Yeah, so that's why... Well, that's why I'm posing the question. That's basically the major reason why I'm doing it. So,
but you know,
what we're
going to
do right now.
And I posted them on Facebook.
I'm sorry?
Today. I filed two articles
yeah.
out there, and I posted them on my Facebook page today and on the Bree Life radio show page, the event page. And it's funny, you know, because one of the articles was saying that a majority of blacks are dissatisfied with black leadership today. And they said somewhere mm-hmm. about 85% of the black community aren't happy with the black leaders that we have today. And then we also had another one from the Washington Post that said black leadership is dead. Long live black leadership. And the funny thing is I had a white blogger from Peoria to answer. And, you know, and it got kind of sarcastic about it and disrespectful. Yeah, you guys are bemoaning black, the lack of black leadership. You know, like, come on, you know, if we could just find one prominent black one black leader that's very prominent that happens to be black or something like that. So, and I was just wondering, where do you get off at trying to tell us that we can't be dissatisfied, you know, with our black leadership? You know, who are you? And I hear black. I mean, the white community, when the kids go around and they're shooting each other every weekend or things happen in the school district or they go up and down the street tearing up people's yards and everything, stuff like that, nobody cries out more than these white bloggers and these white leaders in the community here in Peoria. I don't know what they do there in New York, but the first question they always ask us is, where are the black leaders at? Where are the NAACP at? Where is Don Jackson at, or these people? They're the first ones to cry, where are our black leaders? But when we ask where are our black leaders, we're wrong for doing that, you know. Or we must be playing the race card. And I wonder where did they get off doing that, you know, because that's the first thing they do is say, oh, you're going to play the race card like you're going to gate, you bringing up racism or something. But this has nothing to do with them in the first place. We're talking about our own community, our own people, and what we feel like we're not getting, you know. Now, these are the people
exactly.
in the cold now. So,
and you know what? What we're going to do right now, we're going to take a commercial break. When we come back, I'm going to bring up, if you'd like to, bring up your Facebook page and read what the blogger wrote and then read what my response was. And that'll give our listeners a better understanding of why we're posing this question.
Okay.
Just his comments alone made it clear that these questions have to be asked regularly, because there are other ethnic groups that are paying attention to us, to people of color.
Correct.
And wondering where we stand on a lot of issues. And if we're not present enough, they just think that we don't care about our communities. And that's already the assumption for those who live in urban neighborhoods.
That's correct.
There are those that would think that because you live in an urban neighborhood, you don't care. So we have to do whatever we can to dispel that perspective. We can't attack everyone's perspective and their perception, but asking these questions, having the dialogue, sharing information, and taking that information and infusing it in our neighborhoods and in our communities to improve, again, the quality of life for ourselves, for our children, it will make the difference. So, again, what we're going to do right now, we're going to take a commercial break. When we come back, we're going to examine that question on General's page, and we will be joined with one of our panelists, Zakiya Ansari. I want to thank you all for listening, and stay tuned.
Green Life Radio is a grassroots radio show offering a voice to everyday people. It is without a doubt that this service is a pleasure for we at Green Life to provide. However, this service comes at a cost. For us to continue to provide this valuable outlet to the community, we need your support. Join us as we raise funds to keep Green Life Radio streaming while we provide assistance to Public School 161 in Brooklyn, New York. 15% of all funds raised will go towards providing school supplies to the students of this necessary and vital educational institution. You can find more information about our fundraiser on the web at grilife.evenbright.com. That's grilife.evenbright.com.
And we're back. You've reached the Bree Life Radio Show. I'm your host, Bree. And tonight we have part two of Where Are All the Black Leaders and Organizations? I'm being co-hosted tonight with, and joining me tonight is General Parker. General, welcome back.
Hello.
Okay. I thought I lost you there. Well, before we went to commercial break, we were discussing a comment that a blogger had made on your page with regards to the question that we're posing tonight.
Right.
Did you happen to bring it up?
No, I'm not at my computer now. I was hoping you could bring it up.
Okay. Well, I brought it up, and I won't disclose his name, but I'll read some of his comments. He says, if only there was a national leader of some prominence who just happened to be black. And then your response was meaning. And he says, I mean, come on, bemoaning the lack of black leadership? And your response was, sometimes I think you are smart, and other times you prove to be, I won't read these words. Furthermore, I think the point General was trying to make is that as a person of color in his community, he has the right to ask the question. And it's not that anyone is bemoaning. It's not that anyone is trying to tear down a leader or lack of leadership. We're asking the question because if there isn't someone present, then maybe we all need to rally around an individual who's strong in the community and sort of encourage them to stand up. And it's our right as people who live in our individual communities to do so. So General's response was, you inferred I was the author of your response. Secondly, your offhanded remark is neither valid or relevant, regardless of what you think about it. The reasons why are, and that one, he's white, and two, he doesn't live the type of life that an African American has. So what I did was I came on his page, and I wanted to diffuse the rhetoric. So what I said was, all communities are not the same, and leadership isn't always present. I believe that some men and women are now taking a more serious and active role because our president sent the call for us to be more involved in our communities and holding elected officials accountable. Anyone who lives in a community that has a lack of resources and presence of representation has the right to bemoan. I support the leaders all over the country that are standing up, not just for photo ops, but for their people. Enough said. So, General, tell me, did that statement help at all with shutting him down?
Oh, he didn't even respond. So I think he had nothing else to come back with when he asked if we disagreed to tell him why. I think we let him know why, you know. So
mm-hmm.
He got it.
So in total, here ended the lesson. So now, moving on, we can bring on our first guest panelist. Her name is Akia Ansari, and she is the Advocacy Director for Alliance for Education.
Good evening.
Season blessings.
How are you?
Good evening. How are you tonight?
I'm good. I'm well. Interested in listening to the conversation.
Thank you. Thank you. So for our listeners, Zakiya, first of all, I want to thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for inviting me.
We really appreciate your participation. And I want to introduce you to General Parker, my co-host tonight.
General Parker.
Hi, Zakiya.
How are you?
Doing?
I'm good. Thank you.
Good. Thank you. And happy holidays.
And if you could, please uh-huh. share with our audience what you do and the upcoming event.
Sure. So my name is Zakiya Ansari. I'm the Advocacy Director for the Alliance for Quality Education. But before I became the Advocacy Director, I was a volunteer parent with the organization for about four to six years before there was an opportunity that arose for employment, and which is why I swear by the power of volunteering, I happen to be in the right place at the right time. So for the last 4 years, I've been working with AQE. And a lot of the work that we do and I do is working with elected officials. A lot of the work that we do is pushing back against, you know, cuts to education. We are a statewide organization. I am located in New York City, but we are in all of the big five cities, you know, Rochester, Syracuse, Buffalo. We're in Albany, Long Island, and have branched out because budget cuts have been so bad into, you know, normally areas like the suburbs and small rural areas. And it's been really, unfortunately, we've seen $1 billion in cuts in education. And a lot of that has to do with educating, and I heard General Parker say something about education in regards to the work that he does. It's been educating parents, empowering them, young people, community members, and others to step up and speak out, and I think to your conversation, bring forth leadership from the ground up.
That's wonderful.
Absolutely.
And about the 28th, we are part of an organization called New Yorkers for Great Public Schools. We are made up of labor, clergy, community organizations, youth groups, and we've come together to not to choose a mayoral candidate, but to create an educational agenda that forces mayoral candidates to look at a new direction in the way our public schools are being run right now. Because I don't know if all your listeners are aware that after 10 years of Mayor Bloomberg, only 13% of Black and Latino children are graduating high school, college, and career ready. And I did say 13. So clearly,
13%.
Yes, 13%. So clearly,
and do we know what the percentage was? prior to Mayor Bloomberg, his
we
tenure?
We don't, because they just started to, I think it was last year or the year before, they started to create a rubric for judging college readiness. So we never had it before. So they just started, they just created in New York State, they just created this rubric to make the determination. But we also know that, you know, 140 schools closed already since 2002. You know, unfortunately.
And how many are slated to close? Do you know that?
Well, right now there's 36 elementary and middle schools that are not necessarily slated to close. They call early engagement. So they haven't done well in regards to these progress reports, if you believe in them. You know, where they labeled schools grade A through F. And so now they're in this early engagement process. Normally we would have gotten the high school closure list, but I believe it's because of what happened with Hurricane Sandy that they haven't put it out yet. And my fear is that they'll put it out, you know, Friday evening, 5 o'clock, you know, whenever no one's really paying attention. And then it gets kind of lost, and, you know, I mean, our organization will definitely be on it, but that the masses won't know about it. And unfortunately, they've done that far too many times, and I care to count.
And with the schools that are in early engagement, would a school that's very near and dear to my heart, PS 161, happen to be one of those schools of early engagement? Because I heard a nasty rumor that 161 was going to be closing.
I don't know for sure. I don't. And I could get that list of schools to you, and you can post it if you wanted to on the page or whatever. I can get that for you after the show.
That would be
great. And then you can post that.
Mm-hmm.
But as you talk about, you know, leadership and growing leadership, like, to me, this is the core of it. If we're not educating our children in a city in, like New York City, where more than 70% of the children are Black and Latino, yet 13% of them are graduating college and career ready, yet the 140 schools closed were in those communities where they're immigrants or a large Black population, where do we get our leadership from if we're not educating our children? And I think part of the work that we do with our organization is that we are creating leaders within that of parents, right? So, and I think that's where it happens, right? It happens from the ground up. I mean, look at our president. He was an organizer. And he used and worked that organizing skill like nobody's business for this campaign, right? And then the people that he employed, they were on the ground, hitting the doors, knocking on them, talking to people, not sitting behind a desk, you know, hoping or making some phone calls. They probably did a little bit of that too. But their game was hit the ground and talk to the people.
Right. And part one and two of this particular show topic was dedicated to President Obama because of his grassroots beginnings, which is the foundation of the question that I'm asking. So I'm asking you now, what do you think the state of our Black leadership is? And where are all the organizations, to the best of your knowledge? I hear that you have aligned yourself with other organizations. I think the work that you're doing and have done is fantastic. It's much needed. We all are leaders, whether we have a title, a 501c3, or not. So my question to you is, what do you think the current state of Black leadership roles in our community, because you live here in New York too, is?
Right.
And what do you feel that's great about it, and what do you feel that could be improved?
So, and I'm trying to, for me, a lot of my work is, so there is the political piece in regards to, like, Black leadership, and I think one of the things that frustrates me so about leadership over the years, especially since education is my thing, that's what I generally will fall back on. But in regards to knowing that there are caucuses on every level of government, right, local, state, federally, and while they are supposed to represent everyone, they're a caucus for a reason, right? They became this Black, Latino, Asian whatever it is, whatever that caucus is, or Congressional Black Caucus, or whatever it is,
yes.
it became a caucus
yes.
because they realized that there needed to be this bond of folks that could get, that understood each other's plight, and that could hopefully fight for the people that, the people they are representing in their community, right? And my frustration mm-hmm. lies in that there's, the people, though, that they are representing don't feel that they are representing them. And so it's always been my goal and my focus to try to not only bring the word and the stories of those folks, not only through my own stories, but have parents and young people share their stories with them, but that they then do something to be outspoken and out about the issues in regards to education, again, for me specifically. And so whether it's engaging the Black, Latino, Asian caucus on the local city council level, we've done that, or the Progressive Caucus, we've done that. From the state level, where we reach out when it's time on budget stuff, and we really broaden them and come and talk to and educate them on what's happening in our community. Because often we believe, we think, I think as parents, I know I did in the beginning before I was had a little more education on this, that they knew what was happening. I just assumed that they knew that there was 140 schools in New York City that were closed. Right, and that there's another 36, and that the list comes out at this particular time, but they don't. And so instead of, which what made me angry, instead of being angry about, like, how could you not know? You're saying you're representing us. We voted for you to be representing us. It's about
right.
teaching, right? It says if they don't know, then we have to bring the knowledge to them. And then the hope is that, not the hope, and then it is our job to make sure they step up to the plate and be those leaders. So that's part of the frustration on that level for me. I think what's good about it is when it works, it's a great thing for a couple of reasons. One is it lends a sense of hope when in our communities there's so much hopelessness, that there are others that are out there willing to step up and fight for you, have the voice, have the ears of others who can make the change. But also stand on you on a local level, whether it's at your school or the press conference, saying, no, we don't want our school closed because it didn't get a fair opportunity, or because it was cut $1 million and we lost all these programs, or if it's standing on mm-hmm. steps of City Hall for some other issue. And so I think it just creates this really nice connection of the folks they represent and the leadership, because often we are so disconnected, especially in our communities. Often we don't even know who our city council person is, who's our assembly person, who's our state senator, who's our congressional representative. And at basic, that's what we need to know, you know?
Yeah. That, you couldn't have said it more better. That was perfect.
Right.
That was one. General, do you have a question for Zakiya?
Yeah, I have a couple real quick. The first one is, you mentioned that under Mayor Bloomberg, Black and Hispanic or Latino boys graduated at the 13% graduation rate. Now, it was my understanding that Mayor Bloomberg and a couple of others took the initiative to, and I forget the name of it, I can look it up, because my guy out of Chicago, we deal with this all the time because we had the same problem up in Chicago. But don't you think it's strange that the Jewish mayor would have to take the initiative to try to get more Black boys to graduate from out of the school system than the Black leadership?
And well, I guess I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Okay, so I would just respond to this by saying the 13%, just to correct, the 13% is Black and Latino children overall. In New York City for Black males, like, we're number one at being of having the most African-American males in the country. So we educate, we have the most Black males in this city throughout the country, but only 30% of them are graduating college and career ready. And that's based on the Schott Foundation's 50-state report that they put out every other year. So our males, yeah, are really an issue. To the point of the Black male initiative that was put forth, I didn't look at it as Mayor Bloomberg being a Jewish mayor. I looked at it as, why all of a sudden, right? It was like our organization, AQE, has been around for more than 10 years, and an organization that I volunteer with called the Coalition for Educational Justice has been around for about 6 years. And for each one of those years as CEJ, the Coalition for Educational Justice, we've been pushing back and pushing for, I should say, research-based strategies that we know work that would help our children, even our males. But yet the mayor chose to go to privatization to get private dollars and put some of his own money in, which is great. But the reality is we haven't heard much about it. And history shows, as we talk about history, I heard you know, talking about the historical context, which we clearly know is missing from the classroom, unfortunately. But history shows us, in Mayor Bloomberg's case, that when we don't hear about it, if we as parents and community members and others are not on it and following it and monitoring it never seems to work. And so to say that you're going to put hundreds of millions of dollars, $100-something million, I forget how much it was, I think it was $134 million, into a black male initiative, but no one's seen or heard in over a year now what's happening. To me, if you do that, you want to herald that every day. You want to raise that up, and you want people to know exactly what you're doing, because clearly, if we're saying those statistics about 13%, it's not working. But you put forth an initiative with all these hundreds of millions of dollars, and my question becomes, did you need to do that, maybe, or could you have put that money into something that we know really worked for those, and that would be helpful to those young black males as well? And so that becomes the question. I never really thought of it. I don't think anybody else did, really, like from the, you know, him being Jewish, him being a white male, anything like that. It, to me, it's more like this is Mayor Bloomberg going to his rich friends, saying we need this, as opposed to figuring out a way to raise revenues to stop these big companies and big banks from not paying their fair share, which is something we're going to have to look at now, right, raising revenues. We can't continue to cut. We've cut so much in this city in regards to safety nets, from having to fight against them cutting early childhood programs as well as after-school programs over the summer. Like, it's just insane all the things that have been cut. And unfortunately, guess who it affects the most? Black, Latino, high poverty areas. I'm sure we can name the neighborhoods.
Right.
So something's got to give, you know? Something's got to give.
But I think my
point
is,
what I want to do at, I'm sorry. What I want to do at this time, because we have a caller from the 732 area code, I believe this is one of the guest panelists for tonight.
Okay.
We're going to bring them on the line. Peace and blessings. Good evening. Okay. I don't think maybe they're not ready to speak. We'll put them back on mute, and we'll continue on with the conversation. So one of the questions I want to ask you, Zakiya, because it's, you know, I have a school-age child, and when my son was younger, I was very active in the PTA. I did a lot of volunteering at the elementary and junior high schools that he went to. What do you see as a typical presence, or, you know, that the parents in the communities and the neighborhoods that you support are actually exercising? Do you see a heavy presence of parents involved? And
so,
if not, why do you think that phenomenon is taking place?
Right.
Because
I
remember
when
I was a child, the PTAs used to be crowded.
Mm.
Now I participate in PTAs, and if you have 10 parents present at any given time, it's a miracle.
Mm-hmm. So
what do you think happened?
Yeah, so I'm also, you know, I'm a mom of 8. I still have 3 currently in the public school system.
What? Don't put that in on us. Of how many?
I have 8 children, 7 girls and 1 boy. And I have a new grandson who's 2 months old. And have been very involved in over the years, and sometimes more than others. In my children's PTA or, like, school leadership team, or even some of the citywide parent groups like Manhattan President's Council, et cetera. So I, too, believe of the importance of being engaged and being out there. But I wasn't always, from the beginning of my children's education, involved in the PTA, right? It was through the organization that I'm part of with AQE and CEJ that I started to, which is how I got involved. The teachers were like, oh, please join the PTA or whatever, and I did. And what it was and what I realized is that I came in, and sometimes you have organizations that have cliques. And this PTA at this, my children's elementary school, had that. And when I came in, I was all excited. I was like, we're going to get parents out. And we were getting, like, you know, and this was elementary. So elementary is often the place where you can get more parents. And what I realized is that it was a simple hello for me coming out of the room, because the parents that were already in the PTA would say to me, you're never going to get any parents to come out here. I don't know what you're so excited about. And that was all I needed, right? And it was me coming out of a PTA room, greeting parents in the morning, that we went from 10 parents to 132 parents, right? That we went from 5 learning leaders to 30 learning leaders in the school. And it was just a mutual respect of saying, hello, you know, we need your help. The school needs your help, right? So from the high school level, though, that was a totally different level, a different kind of conversation, where I was the PTA president there, and we didn't have, you know, if we got 20 people, that was a lot. But when you think about high school, most kids don't go to school in their neighborhood, their high school in their neighborhood. They travel because we do have high school choice. And so you might have some
right.
child that lives in Staten Island that's going to school in Manhattan. Not very easy to get the
right.
parent who's coming home from work to attend a meeting, right? So I think while I believe, and in middle school is when we start seeing parents kind of trickle off, because they start to believe, not all, that, oh, they're getting grown, they don't need me around, even though we know, and you know as an involved parent, that that's when they need you more, right? Because of all
oh, yeah.
everything else that's coming out there at them, they need some more guidance. And I found that to be
absolutely.
True with one of my daughters, too, because I know I could have very well lost her and all the wanting to be Miss Social Butterfly and all this other stuff had I not been there and teaches me, like, oh, your mother's in the building, you know, and always having that to fall on. But I will also say
right.
that the economy plays a major role in that, because many parents who probably were home before and could attend and stay and go and do meetings, et cetera, now are working one or two jobs, right? That I can also, you know, also say that, unfortunately, and I'll go back again, through the system and education, like, we're not engaged, we're not invited to participate like we used to be back in the day. And so parent, student, and community voice has been shut out of the system as well under Mayor Bloomberg, where he's taken away, you know, our voice. The only way we have an opportunity to push back or speak about policies in our community is if we stand on the steps of City Hall, either in the freezing snow or in the hot sun, you know, and there's something wrong mm-hmm. with that process. He's created a Board of Education that has most of his appointees on it, 5 borough president appointees, and they have never voted down any of his policies ever in 10
mm-hmm.
years. So there's
well,
not, that's,
I wanna,
not a,
I wanna,
that's not democracy, so yeah.
Well, what I want to do is two things. I want to, one, mention, I want to touch on something you just said about the parents' participation, about how once the children go to a different borough to go to school or whatever, you know, it's my feeling, and as you probably know and my listeners know, I live and grew up in Crown Heights. And I walk through the neighborhood all the time. And you still got to walk through the neighborhood with these kids. And when you see them acting out of pocket, I come from the school of thought that it takes a village to raise a child. And when I walked through the neighborhood with me and my friends, I was cognizant of that, that at any moment, someone from the neighborhood, if they saw me acting up, they were going to rat me out to my mother or my older brother.
Absolutely.
In terms of the participation of the parents, even though my son no longer goes to school in the neighborhood, I still walk up into my old elementary schools, which was PS 221 and 161, and I still go to my old junior high school, which was called Lefferts Junior High School, but now is called Gladstone Atwell 61, and say, hey, I'm here. What can I do?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What do you need help with?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the attitude as people who live in a community have to have when you have schools that are at risk of being closed down, or when you just have a school that has a lack of resources and they need some additional help.
Mm-hmm.
These are the things, and you know, especially for those who are qualified and educated in different principles, they should be go. If they're not working now, I think we all should be volunteering our time, like you said at the beginning of your introduction, that volunteering is very, very important. I don't know what my panel thinks about that, but
I agree that volunteering is extremely important, but I think not that it's like it's not that it is easy. Like if you've already done it and you've experienced it, is that easy? But if you had a bad experience with a school, and many parents do, like the first person at the desk could be a security guard and their mood is not that great and they turn you off a million times, or it could be the school itself is not welcoming to you. So your experience over and over again could be that it's just been a really bad experience. And even if I go to another school, what makes that me think that that school is going to be any different, right? So I think one thing is that schools have to think differently and respect and value the community that they're in, and that parents are very valuable and they have a lot to offer. If they think from that perspective and they start opening up their minds in that way, and many schools do, but if more of them do that, then you will get what you receive, you know, and that welcoming and standing outside and saying, hey, how are you, from the principal or the security agent being really nice, the safety agent being really nice or welcoming you and all those things, it changes and it shifts the culture not only of the parents but in that community, because then that school, which should be a community school, feels like a community school, right? So that's one. The other thing is that sometimes you have to put it out there for parents to and community members and people who are not necessarily parents to understand, we need you, we want you, these are some of the things you can do. And so we have to have a place or an opportunity to share those experiences, whether it's a listserv that happens, like you said, where maybe it's a school in a particular district has a whole list of things that they can really use a volunteer. Is anybody out there that can that teaches art, because there's so much art being, you know, stripped from class? Can you teach the guitar to kids? We have some instruments that are old that haven't been used. Or as a parent, could you help us come and make copies, or a community member? Many people think it's overwhelming. They don't know what to do. So sometimes we just have to put it out there a little bit. You'll get a few people, and then word of mouth starts to carry things. That's how things have always been in our community, right? It's like word of mouth. Oh, how do you know about that? Oh, I heard from so-and-so. And how they get about it. And so that's what begins to change and shift, I think, again, a culture and a community to be more welcoming and want to come into the school. But I think there's some parents like you, like me, and others, many others that I know, that just get it and understand the importance of that, you know, and encourage others to do the same thing, right? So we tend to be the leaders in that and on that forefront of saying, you know what, have you thought about volunteering your kid's school? And either yes or no, they have. And if you haven't, these are some of the things you could probably can do. Why don't you try this, you know?
Well, what we're going to do right now, I believe another one of our panelists is on the line, so we're going to bring them on. Peace and blessings.
Hello?
Oh, hello?
Hi. How you doing?
Good.
Hello? Hi, this is Timothy James. How are you doing?
Yes, good evening, Timothy. How are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
I'm great. Tonight, we're being joined with Zakiya Ansari and my co-host, General Parker.
How you doing, Timothy?
So let's welcome Timothy
I'm
to the dialogue.
I'm doing okay. Sorry for the delay. I was kind of delayed getting home. Sorry about that.
Well, that's okay. We're glad you're here now. So, Timothy, we want you to jump right in. And I'm going to pose the question to you. Where are all the black leaders and black organizations? But before you answer that question, introduce yourself to our listening audience. Tell us about what you are doing now, what you've been doing, and what's on the palette for the future for you.
Okay. Well, first thing, again, my name is Timothy James. I've been working for a state senator for the last 6 years. Prior to that, I worked for an assemblyman and ran a not-for-profit for 5 years. So I've been around community leaders and worked in my community for over 20 years trying to make some positive changes and, you know, and look for the future and hoping, helping other organizations to try and lead and to correct some of the issues that have, how can I put it, kind of infected South Jamaica, whether it was with drugs or other things or whatever. And a lot of these organizations have been there to try and help fight and to bring our community back. So, and I'm in the fight also, working on an organization my own self building for kind of putting that out there in January. So I'm going to be out there really fighting and to working, especially with education, because that's one of the things that is the issue in the Black community. If we can fix our schools in the Black community, our community will survive and strive. And, you know, it's about parents, teachers, and principals working together.
So the question on the table
is... There's a slight delay, and I don't know, maybe that's my phone, but go ahead.
Okay, so the question on the table for you right now is, where are all the Black leaders and organizations?
Well, all right, first thing we have to define what is a leader. We won't get into this. Should we define what is a leader first? you know, look. A real leader is about the community and puts the community first, even above themselves. Those leaders, I'm sorry to say, a lot of them are long gone. We really have to develop new ones, and we got to start with our young people. A lot of the people out there, let's just say people out there today, and I'm not just going to talk about Queens. We'll just say in general. A lot of times they're out for self. They lose focus of what the real mission is to help a community in peril. They kind of lose focus in the mission, and then they go into other things, and next thing you know, it's not about what you originally started. It was about how they can look good to the community or trying to get their names in the paper, you know.
Black organization too, Tim, like the NAACP and CORE.
You know what? Let me tell you something. The national NAACP, yes, they're out there trying to fight those same battles that we were fighting back in the, sadly to say, in some cases in the 30s and in the 20s. But some of our local NAACPs need some work. I mean, some of the leaders, some of the presidents of some local chapters, you know, they need some work. I mean, you know, in some cases they're doing great work and fighting in our community. In other cases, you know, hey, my name is here, thanks, you know, and they're not really taking up strong issues and fighting it until the end. Perfect example is, look, most people should know the Kennedy Airport is going through a $1.8 billion renovation. Now, NAACP was over there fighting that battle and said, oh, they're going to stay there and, if necessary, block the runway. I mean, they said all these things that we're going to do. At the end of the day, the work proceeded, and all they gave the communities of color as far as contracts, I don't even think we broke 10%. And the main contract is not even, I don't even think it's from the United States, that's building a $1.8 billion between the hangar, extension of the runway, and all these things. And it's amazing how we live here, and we didn't see, again, back in the day, there was a gentleman who, and I'm going to mention his name, L.B. Griffin. I'm going to mention this man's name. This man, he's passed away now, but this man took all of his trucks and blocked a very popular avenue in my community, Liberty Avenue. He blocked it because the sewer system that was to be built along there, no minority got any contract. So he took his trucks and blocked that whole area and said, I'm not moving them until you give me a piece of this country. He was the only minority contractor at the time. He blocked that whole area and said, okay, if you can take my 40 trucks and move them, he pulled out ignition switches and all of that to make sure you couldn't move those trucks. And at the end of the day, it took a few weeks, but at the end of the day, they threw him some business, enough business, that he can keep his people working for a couple of years, even though that took about 7-8 years to complete. He got 5 of those years, he had his people working. And seeing we don't have those type of leaders that are willing to do that anymore. We really don't. Because back in the late 60s, early 70s, my mother, along with a group of women, blocked the Brooklyn Bridge, laid across it, and was determined to tell the mayor at that time, either you're going to allow black males to get jobs in the city of New York, or we're not moving. And when he realized how crazy these women were, well, at least he took them as crazy, these were just women that said they're going to make sure that minorities get a job. It wasn't about contracts, it was just about a job. They held their ground, and guess what? Black males got hired. Because there was no, because it was a bad press to arrest all of those women that laid across that bridge. We don't have that type of leadership anymore. Nobody's willing to really just say we're going to do this, and it's not about picking up the gun. It's not about all of this. You know, we're going to break some windows. And they get, no, you don't have to do all of that. If you say, look, we're going to shut down business in New York City. We're going to do it peacefully. They're going to listen to you. Because it's all about the mighty dollar for those who are in charge. If you cut off that mighty dollar, they're going to listen. And it's about us coming together as one and doing it. See, they know we're not. They know that we're disconnected in our communities. You know, hey, Jamaicans don't want to work with Trinidadians, and African Americans don't want to work with Islam. No, look, we're all people of color, and we come in different shades and all of that. And it's crazy how we could literally keep a minority mayor in office forever when you look at the number of minorities that live in this community. So there's just so much that we could be doing if we just worked as a team. Leadership is supposed to come from these people who are elected. And the sad case is that, you know what, until, I'm not saying that they're not trying to lead. The problem is they won't come together to lead. Everybody got to do their own thing. And that's why they get us every time and seem to win out when we should be getting a piece of, like I said, contracts. When it comes to contractors, minorities don't get any contracts. When it comes to our education, okay, there's no reason why minority, we'll just say people of color who are elected, didn't stand up to the mayor and say, look, we don't like the way these schools are going. These are the things that are wrong. You're going to fix this or else. Problem is, you'll get 3 over here that'll say that, and then 3 over here will be like, let's try it for another 2 or 3 more years. Are you serious? Why should we be the guinea pigs for a program that, one, you wasn't sure that worked, and then, two, after you've given it 2 or 3 years, you see it doesn't work, but then you say, oh, we can fix it. So let's continue down the same bad path until we can fix it and make it right. Why should our kids be the guinea pigs? Our children make up a larger number in this system than other children. Right. And then so here we are stuck in this path where schools are not doing well. And I'm gonna tell you, parent participation is key, and we got to get parents back into schools. We won't, you know. I know last time I was
You're
on
absolutely
here,
right,
I went off. I
what
went
I
off on parents,
to...
and people didn't like that. But look, I got to tell it like it is. Even a bad school, and I mean one of the horrible schools in New York City, sent young black males and black females to Harvard. And the one thing that was different from those children than the rest of the whole school was that their parents were up at that school every day making sure that their child was being educated. That's what made the difference. And they shut that school down, but yet 3 of those kids went right to Harvard. So what was so different? Why can't we see that amongst ourselves and say we're going to be up there? And we don't. I mean,
that's a very good question. I want to shift that question to Zakiya. I want Zakiya to address that question. And
because I know that she has time restraints, there's one very important question that Zakiya must answer before she leaves us tonight, and that is, what led you to public service? So, Zakiya, do you want to respond to Timothy's question and then share with us before you leave what led you to public service?
Sure. So I guess in response to, I agree 100%. I think we were just talking about that before you got on, Timothy, about the importance of parent engagement, involvement, that it can be and probably is one of the most important things that can make or break a child, right, in regards to education. But I also think we were talking about, too, the fact that unfortunately many parents, especially in our communities, have not always had the best experience upon entering a school. And often, sometimes that, whether good or bad, is sometimes enough for them not to want to enter again. And that in order for us to shift that mentality, because it clearly has not been coming from leadership in this city in regards to the mayor about the importance of parents being involved, because that's far too many turns. They want us to be involved just on that basic level, right? They don't want us at the table or setting the table in regards to policy, which is where I and other parents want to be at. So they don't necessarily invite us, and the leadership doesn't necessarily, it doesn't trickle down to leadership the importance, I don't believe, of parents and communities and schools. And so unless you have a progressive principal in the school, or you have some really dedicated teachers that understand that, and we do have a tremendous amount of dedicated teachers in the city, that unfortunately far too often parent involvement becomes at the bottom. It's not always so urgent as it should be. But I think to the same point is, when you have parents, go ahead.
No, I just hate to say, but you know, I'm hearing you. The only little thing I have to slightly disagree with, that parent participation piece, one of the things that you said, to some degree, that's a cop-out for parents.
I'm
talking about those who, when they say, oh, they had a bad experience in the school, let me tell you something. Who I'm talking about as far as sending a child to Harvard is my neighbor that lives all the way down the street. They shut down that high school just last year. She had her face in that school every day to the point where she was driving me crazy about every little thing about this school. And she was up there every single day just about because she was not happy. Guess what? Her kid went to Harvard. That school shut down. And
right.
I'm sorry,
and
but go ahead.
Happens,
I just had to
no,
tell you.
And I respect that, but I think what happens is then we start putting every parent in the same kind of boat. And so I think that is the average parent. That would be something that I would do too, right? But the question becomes not every parent is that parent. Not every parent is me. Not every parent is Bree. And
what
we then get into is, as opposed to lifting up, and it's not you per se, but I've been in lots of conversations where it becomes, instead of trying to figure out a way to frame it so you're inviting, encouraging parents to get involved, that when I sit there as a parent, I hear people saying, yeah, well, that parent did that, and their child worked, and everything worked out great, and why are these other lazy parents not, I'm not saying you're saying this, but I've been in conversation, and why are these other lazy parents, especially in our communities, don't get out and do anything? And so for me, I'm thinking from a parent, if I wasn't an engaged parent, I'm like, all of a sudden, I like curl up in a ball because I don't want anybody to know I was a parent, and maybe I wasn't in my child's school for whatever reason. And so what I think we have to do is shift the conversation as opposed on the negative, right, which is, well, they need to come out and do this and say, these are some of the great things that happen, right? That story that you just shared to me is an encouraging thing that I want to be engaged in. That's something that I can visualize and say, wow, in spite of, that parent stayed engaged, stayed involved, and guess what? The child that looks like your child could have been your child is now in Harvard. And that's not what we do enough. We always go on the negative. So we got to figure out a way to flip it for you to share that story that you share, which I think is really powerful. That encourages somebody to want to be involved as opposed to maybe something on a negative term. The reason I got involved, as I shared, I'm a parent of eight, and with the PTA and getting involved.
I'm sorry, you said a parent of how many? I'm sorry, I missed that.
Eight.
Oh, okay. My apologies. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
That's okay. And I think my family and I've been on the tail end of stereotypical responses of, you know, having someone who's white of means, having money, automatically assuming that because I have eight children that it was by more than one man. And that's how comfortable they felt saying that to me. Right, so the question wasn't like, oh, that's wonderful, wow. It was like, by how many men? Like, this is someone who is got money. and I just was, like, taken aback by that. But I digress. I apologize. But so my husband and I have been together for 25 years. We've been married for 25 years. And so we're not the norm. And our children will be leaders and are leaders because of us being engaged enough, of them knowing their culture. And my children obviously got me involved in this because I wouldn't be part of the PTA. And it was through the organization, CEJ, that helped train me and give me into experiences with talking to DOE, Department of Education, having meetings with the chancellors. And, you know, I was, believe it or not, very introverted. I was involved in my kids' education, and I went on trips when I could, but if I was at a PTA meeting, I sat at the back. I didn't ask questions. I didn't talk. I didn't do any of those things. And it was through experiences and understanding that our children, and when I say our children, I mean children of color, were being inequitably funded, the schools, for many, many years. Like, I thought my children were in middle school. They had steel pan. When they went to My 11, IS 285, they had foreign language. They had drama. They had access to all these things. At that time, I had three children in middle school. And I just assumed, and I called it taking my rose-colored glasses off, that all schools had that. And it was being involved in this organization that made me open my eyes and say, there's something wrong. It was just something wrong with the fact that 15 minutes or half an hour bus ride away in a district 19 or 23, that those schools for decades had been underfunded and unfortunately far too many not high performing. And it was like a call on me to step up. But I couldn't have done it without having the experiences, learning facilitation skills, connecting with other parents. And it is now that I, you know, go 10 years later into this advocacy work. I'm first starting to volunteer, but then now being employed and being able to do something I love at the age of 40, getting this job and being able to do that, not many people can say that. Now it's empowering other parents. And when I have parents come up to me now and they say, oh, I saw you speak at a conference, or I saw you talk, or I saw you on TV and you were talking about education, go ahead, girl. You know, and do your thing. And that, to me, that's encouraging for me, because it's someone that looks like me that might not have engaged in their children's education or might not have thought about that question that I posed or anything like that, but that encouraged them to step up to the plate, that's what thrills me. That's what keeps me going in this. That's what motivates me. And so it is all of that. Of empowering and educating other parents that look like me, that I know tons of leaders that many of you probably, if I said their names, you wouldn't know. But trust me, each and every one of them are powerful. And I think Timothy said it when he got on, that young people are the key. We work with an organization called the Urban Youth Collaborative. Bree, I was sharing this with you, an amazing group of young students that are in high school. They work from immigration to gentrification to school safety to school discipline. They were able to get the school Safety Act passed with the city council. They created student success centers in four schools in New York City. And these student success centers are run by young people. They're trained. They're usually in campus high schools so that you can get for all the schools are able to participate. They get trained. They get a stipend. And they've had tremendous results. In regards to getting kids who are often their first time and their first person in their family to go to college, to not only apply to one school, not two schools, not three schools, but dozens of schools, millions of dollars of scholarship, and it just continues, right? So they start in ninth grade, they continue through 10th, 11th, 12th, and then you, again, you recycle that. So they are creating generations of shifting and our young people understanding the importance of education, which is so key and so crucial, because they're going to be the most awesome parents ever. They're going to be the most awesome advocates ever. They're going to be the most awesome politicians and elected officials ever. And I think it's about growing your own in the elected official piece. And one of our parents who has 6 children, she lives in the Bronx, she's with Highbridge, she's planning on running for city council this year in 2013. So it's about getting our parents, especially women of color, to understand the importance of running for an office. Because often we are often the caregivers, and we don't think about running for office because, we, you know, like, who's going to take care of the kids? Who's going to cook? Who's going to do this? But we are powerful men, not no disrespect, but I think it's our time to shine, because men have been running this country, granted, predominantly white men, for far too long, and I think it's time for women to step up, and I think we could do a really awesome and amazing job. So that's what keeps me in public service, is connecting to people like you, Bree. It's listening to General Parker and Timothy on this call and the amazing work that they do. It brought me to this show, actually, right? And so I call it a journey that I've been on, and I want parents, I want community members, I want grandparents, I want everybody to start getting engaged in this educational justice movement, because if we don't, we will lose another generation that we cannot afford to lose anymore. And I just want to follow up and end with this, because I do have to leave. Thank you, Bree, for having me. November 28th from 6:30 to 8 p.m. at First Corinthians Baptist Church. New York is for Great Public Schools is having an education town hall. All mayoral candidates are invited to attend, so we hope they will come. 1,500 labor, students, parents, community members from all across the city, not just Harlem, all across the city, holding those candidates accountable, but also sharing their stories,
yes,
from parents to youth about all the issues that have been happening in our city, from co-locations to school closures to school discipline. Be there. We need you there.
You know, Sakira, well, you're a wealth of information, and you need to make sure you leave some of those resources and information with Bree. I don't know if you email it to her or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
We need to post a lot of that stuff that you brought up tonight.
Absolutely. Well, and if you go to the www.nyccej.org, some of those reports that we have, a lot of the information specifically, we just did a report called with the Annenberg Institute called Is Demography Still Destiny? Where we show that your zip code, your neighborhood still matters in regards to the level of education. So, like, in the lowest performing area, which is Mott Haven, only 9% of children graduate college and career ready. And in places like Brownsville, only 11%. Right? So if you go on, it's an interactive map. You can click any neighborhood, and it'll tell you how college-ready are the students in that community, whether they live there or not.
Well,
wow, that's great.
Nakia, I want to thank you very much for participating in our conversation tonight, part two of Where All the Black Leaders and Black Organizations. It is clear that you are one of our Black leaders, and we're so lucky to have you living in our community and caring about the state of education for our children, for all of our children.
And yeah, I was going to ask you that to your ear.
Yes, you definitely are going to have to come back on the show, especially when we begin to talk about education. As we're going to go into January, one of our shows is going to be about the state of education again.
Well, that'll be a perfect time.
In our country, and what are we going to do with our elected officials, making them accountable to lobby for better services and activities and programs for our children.
Well,
so,
thanks, Bree. I appreciate
again,
it.
Thank you very, very much for your participation, and we love you at Bree Life.
Thank you
and
very
I'll be
much.
Talking to
General
you really
Parker,
soon, and
Timothy,
I will be
you.
There on the 28th.
Absolutely. Great, awesome. General Park, if you're in New York, come on down, and Timothy, you should come too. I look forward to connecting to everyone.
Oh, yes, definitely. I have to be there.
All right, good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Well, Timothy.
Yes.
Talk to us.
Sorry I got
now.
On late, because that's... Mm-hmm.
No. That's quite all right.
Because I know I've missed a lot, and I'm, you know...
No, we still have 40 minutes to the show, and we know that you have a lot to share with us. what I want to turn the mic over to my co-host and ask if you have any questions that you want to ask Timothy about his work.
Of course. I just want to paraphrase or reiterate you saying earlier that the true black leaders, what we really call a leader, they're all dead now, right?
Well, I'll put it to you this way. We don't have any more, let's be honest, we don't have any more Powells, we don't have any more Kings, we don't have any more X's. The reality is one of the things that Ozzie Davis used to say is, who is there ready to take over? Who is there ready to take over and to lead in our communities? He used to say that a lot. And the problem is that, you know, there's people that say they want to do it, but again, they want it for the glory. See, all of the work that I've done in this community, it's always been behind the scenes. I don't have to have my name anywhere. Did we succeed at what we attempted to do? And that's all that mattered. I ran a Beacon program for 5 years. All I ever cared about was making sure that the young people that we won, is very most importantly, first and foremost, we had to change behavior, because Beacons, I don't know if you know that, Beacons of Light, they were supposed to be the safe havens during that heavy time of the drugs that infested our communities of color, and that's why David Dinkins at the time was mayor, came up with these safe havens called Beacons. And I ran the original one, that the first one that was started up was in South Jamaica, because, you know, we were infested with drugs back in the early 80s. And that's when that first beacon was there. And I had a chance to run that for 5 years when the lady who started out retired. Then I got it, and then another gentleman took over. But the issue is, it was about, one, behavior, two, education, three, it was about parent involvement. I centered that program around those key issues. And
excuse me, Timothy, you're
work.
Breaking up a little
yes.
bit. I don't know if you're on a cell phone. Yeah,
I'm on a cell
Got
phone.
Got a little echo.
Oh, really? Okay. How is it now?
Okay, there you go.
Okay. My primary focus, again, was mainly changing behavior, education, was about parent involvement. And we worked this, and I say we, even though I was the director, I had my advisory committee, I had a group of parents, and we figured out what we were going to do here that would affect the community outside. And it is with that and that plan that was put forth that we wrote together, that we implemented in that beacon, that made a difference. And it was a hard fight, because a lot of people are funny about change. Excuse me, but one of the things we had to do was not just sit there and absolutely do nothing, because then why do we need the beacon? Heck, why did I need to be there? If we were going to simply do nothing, I can go collect a paycheck anywhere. It was, what was the plan that we were walking in there with, continuing on the dream of what David Dinkins had started and continuing that mission. And, of course, the mission has grown because Beacons have expanded, and the things that they're doing today is expanded beyond what the original startup was. But I just said that to say, if we're not about the community first and ourselves last, we will never get out of this predicament that we're in. And, you know, and it's not always about money. We can change a lot of things just by us coming together, just by each one teach one. And it is not hard. It is just about saying, I'm going to tell my neighbor, hey, look, this is what happened at the meeting. This is what the plan is, what they're talking about. And this next one, pass it off to the next one, to the next one, to the next one. That don't cost any money to do that. What it costs you is a little bit of time, very little bit of effort, using your voice and speaking up and saying, look, this is what we're doing as a team, you know, and we can fix a lot of the problems in our own communities. Yes, some problems do require money. It does. I'm not taking away from that. But some problems require just us taking it upon ourselves to do it. And, you know, what a lot of times the reason why big corporations don't want to give money in communities of color to not-for-profits is because a lot of times you'll give this money and you'll see very little, if any, outcome that is substantial to show that the money that they gave was enough to really show some type of difference in the community. The problem is a lot of not-for-profits just take these dollars and they're like, oh, okay, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. And at the end of the day, the outcome doesn't fit the dollars that were given to them. Yes, not-for-profits are totally underfunded. We know that. There's the Southern Queens Park Association that runs Roy Wilkins Park, totally underfunded. They're in so much trouble now, they could shut down in the next 2 months. And it's sad because that organization has been around for over 30 years. And the largest mm-hmm. budget they've ever had before the cuts was $2 million. And that's sad when they've been around over 30 years. They should be at 15 or 20 million. But again, this is where they're at. And that's because of, and I'll say it, and anybody listening from Queens and got a problem, hey, check it out for yourself. Poor management. Mm-hmm. And they never, ever could pull all of the organizations that are affiliated with it to come to work as one united team to bring in corporate dollars. Because the city of New York gives them just enough to survive, and they say, okay, go find your other money. And they don't know, and the other piece is they don't know how to do it. So when you talk about where these black organizations are, you know, you got a lot of them that are there that are unfunded and out there doing good work, and I give them that. And then you have some that are funded or underfunded and trying to hold on and, you know, and trying to do what they can with their budgets to do something for the community. And then you have some that are funded and need, and be honest with you, need to close. And that money needs to shift to another organization that can provide the services. Not-for-profits, some people go not-for-profit, quote-unquote, just for the dollars that they can write off on their taxes. And, you know, and I'm being honest with you, we've had some problems where minority not-for-profits have not been living up to what their mission statement says. And for
Absolutely.
That reason,
yeah.
And for that reason, why other not-for-profits are losing dollars, why corporations are walking away. We've got to make sure our books are in order. So when they come in to take a look at what you're doing, we've got to make sure we've had our audits, and they look and they see that all the dollars add up, and the outcomes from the mission statements add up, and everything, and it shows that we were able to do things that, and we did it without having enough money, and somehow we made it work. And that's what corporations want to see. They want to see that you made a change in that community that is clearly visible to them, where they can say, okay, we're going to add some dollars to this, so now we expect you to have a bigger outcome. And they will. There are corporations who have made millions of dollars under our president. When they talk about, oh, he doesn't like corporations, yes, he does. They've made billions, and they do give out money in communities of color. They do. But the problem is only certain organizations are getting them, and that's because they bring on certain people on their boards and whatever. They're able to get those dollars, while other organizations that work just as hard can't get a dime. And that's truly sad, because one organization is not gonna settle the issues in South Jamaica, you know, Queensbridge, and all the areas of Queens. There's several not-for-profits out here. The problem is only a few get some of the real dollars that are out there, and then they're expected to do, for the little money that they get, they're expected to do so much, and they don't even have enough staff to accomplish their goals. And you know, so there are a lot of problems with minority not-for-profits. We need to pull our resources together. That's another thing. But again, it seems like we're embedded with this. We can't trust or work with one another, and we have to remember that we don't need to duplicate services. We do need to make sure that the services are strong, but we don't need to you know, constantly duplicate. There's other things that need to be done. I mean, you know, I'll see.
We also need to, when you talk about sharing resources, that's very poignant because we also need to refer between organizations.
Yeah.
We need to have a referral service. We have to have a collective of non-for-profits offering real services to the masses. And where we align ourselves with one another, if one of us has a weakness or a soft area and you have a stronger area and I can refer somebody to you, but I'm providing services that you know, it needs to be referral among the non-for-profits.
And collaboration.
I don't hear a lot of organizations doing that also. What I want to do right now, if I could, I want to tell our listeners, because, one, we have some callers in queue that probably want to come on and ask some questions. I know that there are two or three people that will be calling in shortly, and I want to remind everyone that we go into overtime. So in order to remain listening to the show, if you're listening via your laptop or desktop computer but if you're listening on your computer, you have to call into the guest call-in number, which is 424-220-1862, so that you can be on the call after 11 p.m. when I officially go off air recording, but we may run into overtime. Also, what I'd like to do is, Timmy, I want to ask you, what led you to public service? What was the thing that just, you know, pushed you into public service? Do you remember? Is it something that happened as a child or later on in years? Tell us what
definitely
led you to public service.
My mother laying across that bridge with the other black women who were determined to get jobs for black males. That started it.
Mm-hmm.
But also my mother working for an elected official. And I, at that early time, that particular elected official was truly about the community before, I guess, as time went on, you know how it is, that money gets good and you kind of lose focus from what your original idea was. You kind of lose focus, and a lot of people say that about that gentleman, but we'll just say this. In those early years of that gentleman out there fighting in the community and me watching what he was doing and my mother was right there, I was like, wow, this is what I want to do. And because you saw the outcome, you saw the difference, you saw the fight taken up of we're going to move these drugs to the next corner, to the next corner, to the next corner until we have it totally out of our community. When we were fighting to make sure that, hey, we're going to have a sewer system in South Jamaica. We're going to make sure that our people get some of those contracts. When I saw that these things happened and that they were that they took up a fight, it wasn't about the gun. It was about we're going to have a protest that's going to, at the end of the day, you're going to give us what we want, and we ain't got to sit up here and get into fights or whatever. We're going to shut off the dollars, and then you're going to listen to us. And when I saw how they strategically went and planned and fought the city the way they did, I said, you know what? I want to be a part of that. I want to be a part of making history for our community, making sure that our community benefits. And, of course, then there was the fight of the schools and the things and desegregation. All of these things took place. I was able to be there and see it. So as I was growing up, I was like, wow, okay, I need to be a part of this. And you begin to learn, and there's really no school that can really teach you that. You really have to be there and hands-on and watch it happen and see how they planned and worked as a team, and they had planning meetings, constant planning meetings. This is what we're going to do next week, and we're going to force the mayor's hand, or we're going to force this elected's hand. And this is what community. This is what it meant to be community leaders coming together and planning out what they were going to do to force this elected official to listen to the needs of the community. That's what they did. And taking that type of planning and that type of leadership.
And that's well, what led you to public service.
Oh, yeah. And then, you know, and lucked up and a politician hired me and I saw the work that he did and fights very hard and then, you know, and then working for the one I'm working for now. It's, you know, it's about standing up for what you believe in and making sure that, you know, and a lot of times, and I understand why politicians a lot of times don't, because you'll stand up there, like I've seen the politician I work for, stand up there to fight the governor on an issue in our community and be like, look, that's right, and we're going to actively work to get you out of office. If you don't do what we're telling you to do, you better do it or else. And then the governor just peeks behind you, and he sees nobody behind you. He's like, you in what army? See, the deal is when somebody says that to you, you should be able to look behind you and says that army right there, and we're going to move you out of office in the next election. That there
right,
is the leader that brought the people strength in numbers. And that's the only time when you frighten an elected official. You can't go alone to threaten them to say we're going to put you out because you didn't fulfill your campaign promise. No, you take 100, 200 people with you, and you say, here's my army, and this army is going to be out there on election day making sure that you don't get elected. And that is when they move. That is when they listen. But we got to hold them accountable from the first day that they get elected so they never lose focus on what their job is. And that's another thing that we in our community don't do. Because I'm telling you right now, we had a president that's been in there 4 years, and we still haven't given him the agenda for the people, for people of color in this country. But everybody else has given them an agenda. Business leaders, white folks, and everybody
right. Yes.
else. But the people who out there fought hard the most, we have yet to give them an agenda. And
I'm sorry, General, what were you saying?
I wish he was on the call the last time, and I really don't think it's not that we haven't given him an agenda. Is when we've tried to, we've been met with so much opposition, especially from our own people, who felt like, who are you to question him, our first and only black president, you know? And
you're right.
My question still goes
out. Well, what we're going to do right now, I see that we have a caller from 651, and I know who that is.
Yeah.
It's our brother Mark and guest panelist.
Happening, folks.
Good evening. Peace and blessings.
Peace and blessings to everyone out there, the Free Life Listening Radio fam. Bam! Yes, sir. Yes, indeed.
So the question tonight, Mark, is where are all the black leaders and black organizations? And I know you have your own personal feeling about leadership.
We've gone over this before. Everybody, to me, I think, and especially the black, I think the people of color, black people, soul people, resonate and vibrate at a different frequency, and they are the same when they're not in their right, you know, frequency. And the problem is we try to utilize a system that's going to push back. I was talking to a friend today, and I was saying, you know, it's like you know how to play volleyball. And let's say you play volleyball in a gym. And someone says, okay, let's go play volleyball in the ocean, in the water, in the pool. And you say, cool, I know how to play volleyball. You ain't thinking very much about the medium, not realizing that, yes, you know how to play, but you have no idea the muscles and the alteration that medium that you're moving into is going to have on your skill set, even though you're very proficient. And if you look at beach volleyball, for instance, versus hardcore volleyball, you see, if you look at the Olympics, you don't see, it's a lot of those indoor guys that could not play beach volleyball. They couldn't do it because that medium, which they, even though they have a skill set, they're out of sync on that medium. And I think that us soul people, we really think and vibrate differently. And but we feel like, oh, I got a mind, I got a brain, I got this, I got that. Yeah, we do have those things, but we're not in the same element that we came from. You know what I'm saying? And so we have a culture, that a dominant culture that does not know how to embrace that, and have not known how to embrace that, has manipulated it, has done all kinds of things with it. So now when we try to get, whether it be justice or anything else, it's really hard because we're on the sink. So now people always say, well, black folks don't get together. Well, it's not a mystery why that happens, you know. And it's not because it's crabs in a barrel or anything else. It's that we're not in sync. We're not flowing together. So even with the whole black organization, it's really hard to work interorganizationally because everybody's on different frequencies. You know what I'm saying? So being able to come up with an overall agenda is hard because we have to admit that we are out of sync first. But we don't. But I don't think a lot of people think that. They believe they know what it is that we need to do. You know what I'm saying? So the first thing I always suggest is you need to first of all find a leader that's in you, because you're looking for someone. You're looking for Moses. You know, you're looking for somebody to take you to the promised land. And what I'm saying is that you were created as a person that can lead themselves. So when I get with any gentleman, it's not that I understand we need a spokesman. Having a spokesman is not the same as having a leader. A spokesman speaks for the body. The body is in agreement. So the spokesman speaks for the body. But a lot of us are not looking for a spokesman because we haven't found our voice. Because when I find my voice, then all I ask the spokesman do is to represent and amplify what I'm saying, as opposed to speak for me, because I do not know how to speak for myself. And so we have surrendered, whether it be to our black leaders or to white constituents, we surrender because we don't have our own personal voice or belief in our own personal voice. So that's kind of my, you know, mumble jumble jibber jabber about leadership. I just think that we have a tendency not to really understand who we are, you know. And so when we try to get organizations together,
I'm going
to
ask General, do you have a question about Mark's statement?
I'm trying to get this question together, though. I heard what he said about we're looking for Moses, and I agree with him that we need to look inside of each one of us and find a leader inside of us. But I feel just like with the Hebrew people in the Bible, and they were a powerless people. That's the state of black America today, you know, and without having the power that we need, I think we do need a Moses to lead us to the promised land, because we don't have the power economically, you know, financially.
Well,
even now spiritually, they've even broken our spirit. That's one thing they used to couldn't be able to break from us, you know.
I want to jump in right
hold
there.
Up, hold up.
I believe we do have the resources. I just feel that individually we misappropriate them and we don't prioritize how we spend our money.
But, you know, we just spent over a whole hour on education, though, Bree, a whole hour thinking about education, and that's where it comes from. And they've taken over our education. And I do a lot of work with the Black Star Project out of Chicago.
But wait a minute, hold up now. Okay, I got to say this. Wait a minute, hold up. Whose fault is that they took over our education? They did it right in front of our face. That's just like we all just sat there, and here's a person that walks right. We're sitting in a row, and we're watching this person walk right by us, take something that we put right in front of us, and just keep walking. And we're all watching this person doing that, and none of us reach out our hand and say, wait a minute, give me that. Who the heck are you to take this? We let them do it.
Doesn't that go to our question tonight? We're our black leaders, you know?
Let me say this real quick,
being said, and I'd like to add maybe another perspective to this, and it's back to what I was saying about being out of sync. You said we let it. I think if you're not in sync, it's not so much you're, by default, obviously you do let it, but that that's not your intention to let it. So what happens is when you're not in sync, and as far as needing a leader or Moses, first of all, I don't believe the Hebrew people were weak people. I don't believe that we are weak people. But if you do not recognize your strength,
let me tell you
what happens a lot of times, because it happened even with the Moses example. What happens now is when you do, if you operate from the premise of that I am weak as opposed to I am strong, and I'm just not, see, it's one thing to say I am strong, but I'm not using my strength as opposed to saying I am weak. So if I believe that I am weak, then I do need a Moses. But then what happens is if Moses can take me out of the promise, take me to the promised land, then I'm going to need him to sustain me in the promised land. I'm going to need him to establish me in the promised land. I'm going to constantly go to him. And so my point is, as a spokesperson, remember, we need more of a coach than we need a leader. And to me, if you look at a team dynamic, when you have a coach, the coach ain't on the field playing. He basically understands that you are necessary for us to win. So therefore, what he does, he encourages, he gets behind, he pushes, but he lets them know, without you, we are not. This is not me. And so they know when they're going out there, they're not constantly looking over at the bench to see what the coach is saying, because they have confidence that they can do what they need to do as a collective. So I'm saying as a collective, as individuals, we are strong, number one. Number two, we may not be aware or in control of our strength, but we are strong. We're not weak by any means. Number two, we have surrendered a lot because of the fact that we were brought into a system and are in a system that is made so that we do have struggles succeeding in it, meaning sustaining success. We can get successes, but we need to understand the nature of the structure. Structure dictates movement. So if I don't understand the nature of the structure I'm in and how to sustain successes in this structure, and that is going to be a struggle because it's not meant for me to have smooth sailing in this structure, then I'm prepared for that, number one. Number two, I am ready to acknowledge the fact that I can do this, but I have to sustain some level of momentum. And so we have problems sustaining, because think about it. We've had all kind of quote-unquote movements, but they ebb and they flow, and they ebb and they flow, and it's hard to hold some sustaining strength. Number two, number five, however many numbers I'm using, because I know I had a bunch of numbers. The other thing, other point, we were talking about the president and holding him accountable, whatever the case may be. The president is the president of the majority, not a minority. He was elected by the majority, not the minority, number one. Number two, and with all of that, we have to acknowledge the fact that we can bring things to him if we want to, but we need to understand what he has the power to do for our community in the first place. But first, we have to acknowledge we are strong and that we're going to make a commitment to walk in our strength. And that's
okay,
what
I'm going to stop you right there, Mark. What say you, Timothy, on what Mark has just said?
Okay, all right. I'm hearing you, Mark, and believe me, I'm agreeing to a point that, for one thing, again, I have to go back to that piece of education, I come from an era when our parents stood their ground and forced the principal to do as they say, but all of the parents got together. Now, I do realize in today's system, we have a lot of, a lot of these parents are very young that are coming into the system, and they don't have the same values. Believe me, I understand that. So, yes, we need to, we need to train these parents. We need to make sure that they understand what it means to be a parent and what is the one of the most important things for a child to have a shot at a future in Miss America. And we have to make them understand that education is the most important thing. And again, and then taking it to our president, we got to make sure that he understands that, yes, Race for the Top was a good grant, but we also need something else. to make sure that communities of color are getting the proper funding? Because this fair, I don't know what state you're from, but this this formula, this funding formula that's used here in the state of New York, never seems to add up in schools of color. It never does. Somehow.
Well, you know what? Let me say this real quick. I hear what you're saying. I'm from Chicago originally, so I remember, and I don't know how old you are, but I don't have a problem telling my age. I'm 50 years old. So
I'm only a couple of years younger than you.
Right. So my era doesn't see a whole lot of activism among parents in the school system. In my city, in Chicago, Chicago has never been one of the greatest cities for education, number one, as far as definitely minority education. What I noticed back then, when Jesse Jackson started Push Excel at my high school in 1976, when I first was a freshman, he came there and started the Push Excel program to work with schools on getting, because it was always and has always been a problem in our schools. Our parents weren't very, in my area, my parents and our parents weren't very active in the school because most of our parents had to be at work. They weren't able to be there for a lot. So we trusted teachers. And when we had one or two or three teachers that we really remembered their names and did some things, if they're called home, the parents believed them. But I'll be honest, my mother, as well-meaning as she was, she didn't know what the hell was going on. She really did. She didn't. Now, I appreciate in your geographical area, on your block, and your neighbor that happened, but I think far too many of us remember around the country that our parents weren't at school. Black folk, they've been known to be big in the PTA. That's the reality, because like I said, a lot of times we grew up, a lot of us did, I'll emphasize, maybe not in your geographical area, but I knew a lot of folks that their father wasn't there. Mom was doing all the work, so when she could, she could. I don't even know how many fathers that even went to a school, even when you did have a father. So it was kind of, to me, black education has always suffered. It's not now. To me, this is, and even if you say girls don't know how to parent like they, maybe their moms did, I still remember, again, there was a lack of parental participation in the school system. They trusted the teacher more. And sometimes we were fortunate because our teachers may have lived in our neighborhood, so that helped a little more. But the truth is, my experience, it wasn't a lot of parental involvement, even back then. And it never has been a lot of money directed to the black schools, the inner city schools. So we always had the older books. We always had the fewer this, the fewer that. So that ain't nothing new. To me, this is old. To me, this is a continuation.
Wow. Okay, well, you know what? I realize every state is different. I can tell you, in the state of New York, I can tell you this clearly, that PTAs in my era were full. My parents used to take me to the PTA meeting, and I would sit there with
the
guys that was
to me earlier.
Hmm?
Same thing.
Yeah,
right.
That's why I said, you know what?
In the PTA.
But you know what I think? And I don't know. I would dare say, because I know a little bit about Bree's background, and she has to admit that her upbringing may have been a little different than the people that were in Bedford-Stuyvesant or were other places. I think you all have to admit that the level of education or access to certain finances and understanding had more to do with our socialization and our ability to manipulate a system, because the poorer area.
I need to interrupt you right there, Mark, and say this. I grew up in Crown Heights, and yes, I grew up with parents that, well, first of all, my parents separated when I was 6 years old, but my father played a very active role in my life. My mother was an academic monster, and she pushed education on me. I had no option, and I think that is what makes the difference in parenting today. That we don't have enough parents that are academic monsters like my mother. My friends used to tease me all the time because they used to say, does your mother ever work? And I'm like, what are you talking about? They was like, she's always popping up at the school. Well, my mother popped up at the school because she wanted to make sure I was doing what I was supposed to do.
So, but Grace, do you realize what you're saying? What you're saying is almost suggesting that you, because your friends are just laughing, and that suggests to me that it wasn't, that your situation was not there in what happened to them. They weren't used to their parents popping up like yours was, because like you said, yours was a monster, and you may have had those who were. I just wonder if we look at the black collective, and when we pull out those people who have had similar experiences to you and to the other gentlemen,
mm-hmm.
how many didn't have those experiences? I just wonder. I don't know.
Well, yeah, see,
like, I'm not trying to be offensive to anyone to suggest that, you know, my parents are better than anybody's parents.
Oh,
I'm just saying that.
No. And I don't even believe,
But I am saying that, I'm saying that we can't even talk about what was. We got to talk about what is and what's going to be.
Right.
We have to start talking about how we're going to fix the problem. Like, for instance, you made reference to the fact that your school always had the older books and lack of resources and lack of materials and stuff. And that's a problem that's systemic all over the country in urban neighborhoods.
Right.
But what are we going to do now?
It's not new. That's all I was saying.
I want to make a reference point, if I can, to what you said about President Obama and the agendas, the black agendas that are being presented to him and what his limitations may be to addressing them. This is the man we're talking about right now is the very man that wrote the book Accountable.
Right.
And has said throughout his candidacy for reelection that it is very imperative for us as community leaders, as people who live in downtrodden and challenged communities with lack of resources, to begin to make our elected officials, including him,
Can I say this real quick? The reason I say this because I'm gonna have to run. It's funny. I'm at the University of Houston picking up a senior, who I supported through elementary, high school, and college, and I'm picking her up right now as my daughter. So I definitely have been involved. I used to work in the schools, work with kids, families with their IEPs, and so forth and so on. So don't get it twisted. I'm highly aware. I mean, I've been working in social services 15, 16 years. And when I wasn't working, I was a parent that was at the school and was involved. That's why I also know that it was a lot that weren't at the school and doing various things. And I do know that. I know that probably for everyone, we could probably say 20 didn't have a parent. So if we looked at a population of a school being 100, why? You see how many parents probably were involved, if that. You know what I'm saying? And that's just, again, I speak to my experience, and I think I can speak to the overall black experience because I think my experience is probably more common than not common because I believe if Green's experience and other gentlemen's experience was very common, then I know we would have more graduates because
that's not so.
I'm gonna have to disagree with you, brother. But I'm gonna tell you this.
Can I chime in here real quick, please? I need you guys to understand this because, and I might have got confused earlier in the things I was saying, but I want to say this about the education piece real quick. Before anybody goes, the people who control the education of our children will control the future of that culture. Okay?
There you go.
Remember.
Well,
you can have white people principaling and administering and teaching our black kids, and then wonder why they're turning out like they are, and they ain't getting the resources, they're not getting the books and all that. Because, see, they didn't do it back then, so we ended up with what we got today.
Exactly. That is what I'm agreeing with. That was my whole point. That is what I am saying. And that's why I say it is obvious to me that the majority of the experiences were similar to mine, because if it had been more people, really, if the majority of us could say all of our parents, when I say majority, I'm saying, well, if whatever the population of black people are, we could say 75% of the black population, their parents are involved in the schools. If we could truly say that, I don't even think we'd be having this conversation. That's what I'm saying. That's why I believe
well,
that the majority of us didn't have that experience.
Okay, well, let me say this to you real quick before you go. Remember this. If my block, who all went to the school right up the street, we all didn't have to show up to that PTA. If five people showed up, five told the other 25, this is what happened, this is what's going on, and this is what we need to do for the next meeting. See, it's about us telling one teach another. We don't all have to show up, but we can let everybody know this is what happened, and this is what we have to do as a collective unit. And that's what I want to make sure I make that clear. Yes, we had large PTA meetings, but there were many times where there was just a small handful because of whatever that time of was the year where all of the parents couldn't come out. But you better believe we walked down that street and told everybody, and we took the minutes and we put it in their mailboxes and said, you read it so you are prepared
and
for
I
the
think,
next
brother,
week.
All I'm
and,
saying is,
and,
I think that you all had a model. I you might not believe that, but I really do believe that you all had a model, and you all were more of an aberration than you were the rule. Because I believe if you were the rule, if what happened in your experience was endemic in almost most of the black neighborhoods around the country, I just think we would have different results now. That's all I'm saying.
Well, what about the Harlem
children? And you know
what?
Which,
about the Harlem children?
Which is
though,
a perfect segue to a statement that can close out this whole question. Is that if we are the aberration, then that's why we need to lead, because we need to set an example for those who may not equipped or may not have had an example to learn by themselves.
Well,
I don't know how anyone feels about
that.
But
my thing is, all I'm saying, and I will leave on this, is that leadership is important. I just think we need to examine the models that are appropriate for the time that we're in. And I think that we are not, I think that we need to beware. I think that we create lethargy and dependency when we do not encourage people to find their way to lead. That's all I'm saying. I'm saying so the new leadership model needs to be one that requires the followers, if you will, to find their strength, to find their own strength and bring their collective energy so that now we're more of a team with a coach than we are some sheep with a shepherd. I holler at y'all. Love you, Bree. Love everybody. I'm going to talk to y'all next week. I holler.
Take care,
right,
Mark.
Good night. Before we close out the show, what do we think about what our brother Mark has shared with us tonight?
Oh, no. I, you know what? I understand where the brother's coming from, and, you know, I understand what he has dealt with. But, again, every community of color is different. Okay, and, you know, and that what we, how I was brought up and Bree, how you were brought up, that's going on right now in the Harlem Children's Zone. That gentleman created that for going, you know, taking his own experiences, and he created that over there in that Harlem Children's Zone, and that is still going on today because he couldn't have that Children's Zone that he created and still be going on if it has not been constantly under, people are checking on it constantly, there's constant accounting of it to see are they achieving those goals. So if that man up there who started, I forget his name right now, when he put that together and he fought and built that thing from one school to I think there's 20 schools involved, he did that by starting one person and building to what it is today. There's no reason why we can't have a Harlem Children's Zone in South Jamaica. There's no reason why we can't have it in Queensbridge and College Point and all those areas where people of color are, and we should be able to recreate what he has done. There's no reason why we can't. It is just about one person saying, I'm going to do this, take that mirror of what he's done, tweak it to fit our individual areas, and make it happen. It didn't take him money starting out. He needed money later. I know what he did. He went in there and he said, okay, let's take a look at what isn't working and we're wasting money on, and now let's strengthen what is working, and then let's build on top of that. And he did it starting out with nothing, and then he built it into what it is today. There's no reason why we can't do that in all the other areas of the city of New York, because the sad point is that we spend the most money here in the state of New York. The most money is, believe it or not, is spent here. Our problem is that for some reason the management is not well, and we seem to fall below the wayside, and that is a sad case. That is embarrassing. We pay our teachers the less than any other area in the state. New York City, you're paid the least. Principals are paid the least. School aides, all of them make the least amount of money. And let's be honest, UFT, the teachers union, is not strong in any areas other than areas of color around the state. Only in the urban areas does UFT have the type of protection that they do not have when you go into those more rural areas. There's no rule that you have to keep a teacher when you cross right there in the Hempstead. They'll fire a teacher in a minute if their teacher is not performing to the level that they have set. In the city of New York, it takes you 3-4 years to get rid of a teacher. They sit in a rubber room all day, and they're for 2 or 3 years getting paid. You don't have that crap out in Long Island, and your doggone sure don't have that in one of the highest paid areas, Suffolk County. Please, Suffolk County, they'll throw you behind on the minute.
The Sachem School District is the highest paid and most funded school district in the country.
Yeah. And they have no protection for teachers out there. If you are not doing the job, they can throw you out in less than a year. But in the urban areas around the country, you will find UFT has such a tight hold on the system that they can't be thrown, that each bad teacher can't be thrown out for 3, 4, and in some cases 5 years. There's been records of teachers being in the rubber room longer than 3 years, when it should be a maximum of 3 years. They've been in there 4 years. In some cases, they have lasted 5 years, and they get paid while they're in there until you terminate them. And this is the nonsense that goes on. And I'm not saying all teachers are bad. I'm not saying that. What I am saying is this, is that if you don't understand the culture for which you are walking into and you're going to teach those children, then maybe you shouldn't be a teacher in the urban areas. Maybe you shouldn't be.
That's right.
You need to go on out there to those other fluid districts and go work out there. Because let me tell you something, out there, if there is a minority district or children from some of the culture that you don't understand, I bet you you're going to learn it quick. Why? Because you're out there making that top dollar. You got a choice. Either figure out how to teach those kids or find yourself another job. But we can't say that here in the city of New York, because there's so much protection that it will take years to remove a problem. And this is the sad case. That's just only part of the problem of education when it comes to communities of color. There's so many other things and in poor leadership with principals, and again, the parents, what they haven't been doing, and keeping children in their seats to learn. And yes, we have the books issues and, of course, funding. But when you look at New York City's funding, they need to, again, that formula needs to change so it benefits more schools of color. But even when you look at it, the monies that's being wasted in the city of New York has so many, oh my goodness, I'm trying to remember, there was an actual number that they were able to actually prove, the number of consultants that the city of New York has on payroll, and each consultant is making over anywhere between $135,000 to $150,000 a year, and they're only required to visit that school once or twice in a week. And that
right.
is what's amazing. And we have these consultants on staff in the city of New York, all over the city, and let me tell you something, there's hundreds of them, hundreds of these people making this money, and yet the school system and the Federal Report has showed we have only progressed at a modest 5% over the years that Bloomberg has had the system. But you go right out again, just cross over into Hempstead. We ain't got to keep going that far. Hempstead ain't got all of these doggone consultants per capita per child. Or we'll just say they have a small school system. They barely have one consultant. When if you look at and compare that to New York City, they should have about 10 or 15. But they got one, to my knowledge, because I have a friend that works out there who is an assistant principal, said they got one consultant for the whole district, and that's it. And that person is running around from school to school to school and coming up with reports every week. These consultants out here come up with reports once a month. And it's amazing. And you're handing them all of this money, and at the end of the day, the system is no better. So why do we have these consultants? We have to figure out how to, one, we got to get rid of Bloomberg, but the reality is we need to throw these doggone consultants the hell up out of here, because which is horrible, because you're not just having these consultants, you have all of these I forget the name of these other organizations that are working with the schools who are paid, who the school gives up their budgets $125,000 to $150,000 for support organization to deliver services to the school when we had districts that used to do it. So you're paying that money to these organizations, and most of the time teacher training is done once or twice a year. And for that you're paying $125,000 to $150,000 of your budget to that support organization, and somebody in that support organization is supposed to mentor the principal and give some support to teachers. And that same organization has about 30 schools in the area, and that one or two people have to go around and provide the same service to each one of these schools. No school is the same. They're all different. And that still doesn't account for the consultants that the Board of Ed has that you're shelling out all this doggone money for. And it's just incredible. So when you look at a system that is running on about $21 billion, you better believe two or three of it is a complete waste of money. You better believe that.
Well, let me ask this question.
Sure.
Well, go in general.
No, but I'm, and then curriculum. We're going to have to alter the curriculum to fit each and every school, so that because not every child is the same. Just because we're of color doesn't mean we're all the same. And
that's
right.
We're
not all the same learners. Some of us are visual learners. Some of us, we learn differently. And we have to account for that. And it is not that difficult. But when you have the leadership afraid of making those changes, or better yet, they're saying, oh, that would send our system into some uproar, and, oh, we can't just change the system to accommodate a few. It is not accommodating a few. It's accommodating more than half the system. Because when you only have 20 or 30% doing very well, while the other 70 and 75% are at the bottom, something is wrong. So, and after 10 years of you trial and error, and you're still at the same point, because we went up a little bit and then we fell right back down. This, and don't blame the state, look in the mirror and blame yourself. And that is my issue, okay? Because, again, it's not get rid of that mayor, and yes, get rid of the chancellor that might look like us, because you stood there, because, I'm sorry, I said it to Bree before, I'm sorry, a scared nigga is a slave, in my opinion. You afraid to speak up and to tell the mayor what the issues are, what's hurting the system. We don't need you as a chancellor. Hell, we can ask somebody that don't look like us to do the same crap that you're doing, afraid to tell the mayor this and that is what's wrong, and stand up for what's right to help your community. We don't need you as a chancellor. Hell, we can sit back and just do absolutely nothing, and we'll have the same results. Or we can stand up and fight and say, you know what, you're not shutting down another school. You're going to fix it. Don't shut it down. Put the dollars in and fix the problem. just changing a name and a couple of staff members is not the answer. You could have changed the staff while the school was going on. You could have mentored the staff while the school was going on. So,
well, there's
two points I want to make. Don't get me started.
Right. Well, General, do you want to comment to anything that Timothy has shared with us?
Yeah, I've been hearing a lot. Well, first, before we do that, I just want to say I think I was kind of misunderstood. I heard the word weak come up. I don't think I said the word weak. I did say the word powerless. And by being powerless,
I hope that wasn't me that said that.
Oh, okay. But I don't think that we have power politically and all the other avenues that we need to make change for ourselves as a people. So that's why I was trying to bring that up. But talking about the issues, because I do all this stuff here in Peoria, and a lot of times I got to do it by myself because I can't get other groups or other people to stand up for what's right, you know. But I agree with a whole lot of what you're saying, but I also deal with the aspect of the school-to-prison pipeline. And do you think some of the things we're going through there is indicative of keeping this going to make sure that black kids, especially black males, aren't reading at grade level by the fourth grade, getting the education that they need, and plus with them taking the money out of the public school system and then putting up little choice charter schools everywhere and just picking out a few choice blacks out of the community and leaving the other 80% behind, do you think that has anything to do with a lot of stuff you're going through? Hello?
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, I'll put it to you this way. My personal perspective on it is this. Day one, when the system was taken over, when it was changed and the mayor took control, there was never, ever a plan to deal with the lowest performing schools or the lowest performing children. We'll just say that, lowest performing children. There was never a plan to deal with that when they fought and he got the system and it's under mayor's control. He never really had a plan. He kept taking ideas that people kept bringing to him, and as I said earlier, trial and error. Trial and error was conducted on our children. Because let me tell you something, the other children that don't look like us, their schools were still doing great and still what you might have fluctuated a little, but you still showed growth in those schools. Where our schools, for some reason, if there was any growth, maybe one or two percentage points, but then we dropped. So that says to me there was never a plan at the beginning to deal with the issue of education. So when you talk about a prison pipeline, that started back 10 years ago when this mayor took office. Because he's sure enough ensured there's going to be a strong percentage of kids of children of color or people of color going to end up in those empty jail cells that are upstate where this governor is shutting down because he's saying, oh, you don't have enough people, we'll condense them in another jail. Trust me, those other jails, after the mess that's happened over 10 years, I give it another 4 or 5, he's going to reopen those jails because guess what? We're going to need room to put the kids that we failed over this 10-year period since this knucklehead has had the system. And we're going to be sitting there saying, you know, and twiddling our thumbs saying, how did we let this happen? Well, we let this happen when we didn't do anything to get this man out of office. And when that law, and I have to go back to that, I'm sorry, but when that law came up to determine whether or not we were going to renew mayoral control, a group of parents came upstate and said, oh, let's change it. The rest of them stayed silent, complained, but never came upstate to show that governor and the Speaker of the Assembly and the head of the Senate to say this is a bad idea. This mayor has not produced the level of achievement that we wanted to see our schools have. So let's go to a let's take it back and give it back to the communities and take it out of his hands, where we can then say these things are wrong and we can change it a lot quicker. You know, we're the only system in the city of New York that doesn't have a school board. We have a council that has absolutely no power. When we had a school board, which I served on for 8 years, we were able to make effective changes when something didn't work. And if they wouldn't allow us to change, we had an attorney on staff that we sent down there and fought that battle and was able to interpret the law in such a way that we were able to make sure that it went our way. Or we just, you know what, we took them to court. They made it so that we can't sue them, that you got to go find the money on your own to sue when something isn't working. That's why they're able to get away with it so easily, and we got to wait for the NAACP and another group come together to sue the system to then force them to do something about it. They know doggone well when they took that, the first thing they made sure they took out of that law when it changed was they made sure, okay, you can't sue us, and we got to pay for it. You got to find the money on your own. Then they took away our ability to stop teachers from receiving tenure. Did you know the school board granted each teacher tenure, granted each principal tenure? If we were not happy as a school board member, we voted to extend your probation another 2 or 3 years till you were able to show us that you were going to teach our children.
Right.
That's what school boards used to do. That's what they still do in Long Island and upstate Westchester and up in Albany and Schenectady and everywhere else. But in the city of New York, school boards do not exist. You have councils. And we don't do anything but rubber stamp what the mayor says we're going to do. When no in the world, they would have never gotten away with this, lying to parents and telling you what they're telling you, oh, this is what we're going to do. Oh, don't worry about it. We're going to do it this way. Don't worry. There won't be no more arguments about it. And they come right the next day and do it their way. And when we were a school board, they used to pull that crap, and we stopped them in their tracks. We were able to do it because we had the power to do it. And then if they didn't, all right, now I'm going to sue you, and it's going to happen tomorrow. And we used to sue them and stop them, and we used to win all the time. Very few times did the school boards lose a lawsuit against the city of New York because we could hire whatever attorney we wanted, and we always hired a pit bull. And that's why they made sure that was taken out of the law so we couldn't do what we needed to do. And here we are 20 years later, we're sitting in this mess, and we can't, for some reason, that's why, you know, and I think, Bree, you wanted me to talk about the organization that I'm kind of starting up, and because I've been doing this for years anyway, training parents and speaking to them and telling them this is what you got to do, this is how you navigate the system. So an organization along with some great scholars and other community people are going to come together with me, and we're starting up an organization called FIRE, Families, excuse me, I don't know what that was about. Okay, Families Initiative Regarding Education. And we're going to be going into the schools, and we're going to go into the PTAs and talk to them about how to navigate this system. We're not saying be against the principal. No, we're saying that we are going to take a good look at how things are going in the school education-wise. We're going to make them join the school leadership teams, because that's where the power is now in each school, is the school leadership teams, not even the PTAs. And we're gonna make parents understand why it's important to join it, to be a part of it, know your rights, make them read the parent handbook. I forget the name of what they call the book right now, but make sure that you know it inside and out. So that's way when the principal says something to you that this and that, you can't do this and you can't do that, you can quote verbatim in the book that this is how it is to be done. And here it is. Here's the law, written and signed. You have to do it this way. And if we train parents properly in how to do it, and each one trains another, because what we're talking about doing is, guess what? You live on a block with 20 parents, and only 3 show up to a PTA meeting. Not a problem. You got a block association? Okay. If you don't, invite this parent over to your house. Let me explain to you what we were told when we were at the school. And each one, and we're gonna work hard to push them to do that, because that's something that we can do with no money to push to force a school to do better. But parents have to understand how you fight. It ain't about just screaming and saying get rid of the principal, because it may not be the principal. It could be some of the teachers. It could be some of the structure that they have to change in the school. And if you don't complain, they won't change the structure until it's too late, until they're threatening to close the school down. And those are things that I'm looking to do. And through this organization, we're definitely going to do it. We're going to be, again, working with parents, working with other community leaders. That's what we're doing. We're not charging the parents nothing. We're going to be doing workshops. Never, ever will they ever be charged. If I can't get the services that I need donated, I'm not going to go to the parents and say, I need you to put up money. No, we're going to do this for nothing. No matter what, they are going to get the information that they need, and this is how we can fix the system from one perspective of it. Again, the other perspective is we need accountants to walk in there and to really understand how they spend the money, because they tell you how they spend it, but if you don't read between the lines, when they hand you a budget, they never explain it. There is a percentage of the budget that is self-explanatory. Retirements, friends' benefits, okay. We know that's half the system, or really 60% of the system. But there's another 40% that you can play with that you can reorganize to make the school better. And that is the piece that they don't tell you. They don't want you to understand it, because if you really looked in there and you saw how many consultants one school has on staff, you're going to say, what the hell you need this many consultants for? What are they doing? And why is the school doing that bad if you got that many consultants? They never explain that. They never do. They just say, oh, this is what the mayor says we're required to have per school. Oh, really? And you're paying how much? And your budget is how much? Man, you better get rid of those people, because why is the school failing? You know, why hasn't it gone up? Why have they not progressed up high? That person got to go. Just like you would get rid of a principal who's not performing up, so does the consultants must go. And they protect consultants more than they do the principal, which is amazing.
Well,
which is,
I tell
amazing.
You
and that's
are,
why I say,
and I always say this to you, Timmy, I always say this to you, you know, on and offline, you are a wealth of information, and I'm so happy to know you. I think that you have come on, even though you say you were late, I think you were right on time.
you have definitely educated I'm trying to rush to get here.
Our listening audience, and I want to thank you. And it's because of you, not in a negative way, we went in overtime. No, that wasn't a bad thing. It was a necessary thing, because you had a lot to offer. And at this time, I want to thank you for your participation and your continuous support of the Bree Life Radio Show. And I want to thank my co-host for the evening, General Parker. And I want to remind all the listeners to join us next week on Wednesday at our regularly scheduled day and time for Child Custody and Support, Friend or Foe. That we'll be joined again with General Parker and Mike McCormick. They have some updates on reforms that they were very instrumental in getting passed in the state legislative area. In did you get it passed in Illinois, or was it a federal reform, General?
It was an Illinois law.
Okay, so we're looking forward to you and Mike coming on next and discussing with us what that reform was, and
right.
Talking about maybe what the plans are for both of your organizations for next year.
Okay.
And Timothy will definitely be back, as we're going to go into next year talking about an agenda for our respective communities. I think both of you gentlemen have been so gracious enough to agreed to be in my symposium for next year, and we're going to talk about that in future weeks. And again, this has been a great discussion. Part two, where are all the black leaders? Well, all of them weren't here, but there were definitely a few that are strong in their passions about education, leadership, the socioeconomic states of where we are in our communities and where we are nationwide. And I look forward to continuing the dialogue. So in closing, I want our Bree Life listeners, I love you all on purpose. Happy Thanksgiving. And until then, peace and blessings.
Good night.
Good night, gentlemen.
Good night.